This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How are you today? When we were trying to decide on the topics for today's session, the theme is growing up in the city. And we have a lot of interaction with parents. I mean, I've got children myself. The funny thing is when I have conversations with parents and when we probe a little bit more, you will find that in many families, out of three or four children, one tends to have some kind of, you know, learning disability or, you know, what we call non-typically developing children. Dr. Rajani taught me that. I mean, we call them special children. They're different. But I think non-typically developing sounds a lot better. And terminology plays a big part. I spoke to Dr. Rajani and I said, what do you think would be a good topic? And she said, inclusive learning. And I remember Lucy and Amar coming on to talk about inclusive education. Lucy has a special interest. She's done research in inclusive education. Dr. Amar champions children with special needs. And of course, Dr. Rajani, one of the few developmental pediatricians in the country who does sort of monthly shows with us. So we're going to kick off this discussion. If you are running a preschool, if you are a parent, how does this actually work? I know a lot of you are at a loss when it comes to your children who are non-typically developing. So I'm going to start with Dr. Rajani. Why did you think inclusive learning was important? And when I say inclusive learning, it's a bit different from inclusive education.
If you look at children with different needs, if you look at the preschool group, research shows that actually about 20% of children have some form of special need or different needs. Now, not all of them have a specific label or a diagnosis. Some of them have emotional issues. Some of them may have a developmental issue. Some of them may be lagging behind and just need a little bit of extra help to move on. I feel in our society today, while there's a lot more awareness on children with different needs, the understanding and the acceptance within learning environments seems to be very challenging. If I look back to the days when I was in school, there were probably kids in my class who had a diagnosis or a different need, but they were in the classroom. They were not segregated. They were not told, or the parents were not told, you have to remove your child from the school or put them into a special class. And I feel more and more we are seeing segregation within our society, especially in the urban areas.
Dr. Amar, do we have statistics? You're with a government hospital, you're with the government. Do we have statistics of how many children are non-typically developing?
I think we have got data, but the data is not complete. And it's about at least 10 to 15%. But as Rajani said, CDC Atlanta, Georgia would say that 20% of all children today have some sort of learning problem. The majority of them are learning problems, not a child with a physical disability and so on. 55,000. That's the number of children that the Ministry of Education has identified with special needs. But if I take just a ballpark figure of 10%, there should be 660,000 children in the country with special needs under the age of 12. We don't even identify them. They're all over the place. Some of them are not in school. Some are in school. So I think we know what kind of ballpark figure that's out. It's about the same anywhere in the world, but our education system is not identifying it, or actually they're not in school.
Are you not concerned?
Of course, we're extremely concerned. But
what are we doing?
What are we doing? We're Ministry of Health.
Okay. Yes, right. Ministry of Health.
Yeah.
When I say we...
Like Rajani, I'm a pediatrician. We're very happy to see this case and guide them forward. But somebody needs to spot the problem and bring them forward. So some of them are sitting in E-class and D-class, just being, just said they're not smart. But actually, the children with a learning problem.
Okay. Lucy, you have a passion for inclusive education. Why is that?
I believe that all children should be receiving equal education in the setting that both suits them. And I believe that for the vast majority of children, that will mean within the same classroom as all of their peers. We know from educational research that having children who are diverse within a classroom benefits absolutely everybody in that classroom. One of my responsibilities here in Malaysia is the employability of our graduates. And we go out and I speak to Malaysian employers, international employers, and I ask them what skills are lacking from Malaysian graduates and what they'd like to see us do about it. and they don't talk about numeracy and they don't talk about literacy. They talk about leadership skills, they talk about communication skills, they talk about the ability to work with diverse people. And what better way for every child to get those skills than in a diverse classroom? So inclusive education isn't just about children with special educational needs. It's about every child, and every parent should be worried if your child is going to a school that doesn't have diverse classrooms.
So are you saying then special schools for children who are non-typically developing is not a good idea, Dr. Rajani?
Yes, I do feel that. Okay, I'm saying that for the vast majority of children with different needs, of course, there are situations where for the children with the different need that they can't cope in a bigger environment which is noisy, such as a big school setting, and maybe exceptions happen then. But I would say for the vast majority of children with different educational needs, I think we can find a way to include them. It's about mindset and the willingness of the educators, and more so the willingness of the parents of the typically developing children. Because right now I feel the stumbling block actually comes from the other parents. So if you are parents of children who are typically developing, stop and think before you pick on other children who may not be behaving in a way that you are accepting.
Dr. Amar, part of the Malaysia Education Blueprint is actually to look at children with special needs. How far have we come?
When the Education Blueprint first came out, they had about 1,070 words on special needs. Some of us actually complained bitterly. I was one of them. Then they invited us to come back and rewrite their Special Education Blueprint, especially the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. So we rewrote the blueprint. And these are targets that we set that in the year 2015, 30% of children with special needs should be included. And by the year 2025, 75% included. So now we are past the year 2015, we're 2017. I think about 5% of children are included. We have hardly even touched the 30% target. And sometimes the figures are cooked up by including those who are special needs in special classes. They are actually considered inclusive, which we don't consider inclusive at all. So right now, I think MOE has totally not achieved their targets at all. But what's more distressing is on the ground, there's no move to do this. There's no push. There's no drive. There's no interest to do this.
Who are you referring to?
I'm referring to teachers in general. I think at the top, MOE director and other people are very keen that inclusive education happen. But on the ground, as Rajini would know and I know, we actually having lots of teachers trying to push children out, sending them to us, can you please actually send him to a special education class and not keep him in a normal class?
Why?
So how do I know I have a learning disability? Maybe you have a teaching disability, and I think this is the problem right now. We have a teaching disability in the country, but we're not recognizing that. I think teachers not able to cope. Classes are big. You've got 35 kids, you've got two or three kids with special needs. I think teachers don't know how to deal with it and not prepared to.
Teachers in the crowd, anyone?
Hi, my name is Sherry. I'm an international teacher. My school in particular was very interested in inclusive learning and in helping students that had special needs or weren't on the same spectrum as everybody else. But our biggest problem wasn't the resources within our school, because all of our teachers really wanted to help. Our biggest issue and roadblock were parents not wanting to come forward and give us the information on how to create special programming. In my curriculum, we have something called an IEP, which is an individualized education plan. And we had to change our wording of that because parents didn't like it. We had to change it to an SAP, which is a student achievement plan. And that sounded a little bit more exciting. But teachers are willing and wanting to promote this and to help this within their classrooms. But I think it's more of a community initiative that needs parents and teachers working together.
I think it's a chicken and egg problem. All the educational research shows that attitudes are what make successful inclusion. So that once people have positive attitudes to inclusion, inclusion is successful for all students. But a lot of people are wary, and until they've seen it working, they retain that sort of reservation about it. So what comes first, the change in attitudes or the inclusive practice? And of course, it's just a gradual change that has to take place. There is still a stigma attached to particularly some learning disabilities, not just in this country, in many countries, and it's about working gradually at changing parental attitudes, student attitudes, and teacher attitudes.
Okay. Dr. Rajani, do you think we have medicalized this whole special need thing?
Yes. I think in schools we have. And to some extent, it sounds horrible, but there are times when I tell parents, well, maybe it's better you don't say anything until the teacher gets to know your child, but you need to keep a close eye and keep in good contact with the teacher and fellow classmates' parents. And when little things start to appear and then you produce that letter to say, okay, yes, my child is different and maybe you could give her a little bit of extra help. Because I think now, and I see it even with kids that I see, when parents say to me, can you give me a letter so I can show the teacher on the first day of school, I'm always wary about that because I feel, you know, it sounds terrible, but when I worked overseas, we would immediately notify so the kid gets help. But sometimes here I feel if I do that, I'm actually putting that child at a disadvantage. It sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, questions?
I'm just adding to the learning journey because I'm a teacher and I deal with special needs as well. And I just feel that in society we have such a hang up about getting A's and we don't really offer our children different learning pathways. So along the journey, you know, we have students who are very good in sports and some who are good in art, but we just don't have a lot of currency in those things these days. You know, we don't really appreciate artistic or performing arts. And if we are looking at appreciating children with different needs, then we have to work on that as a society first.
I don't know whether that's a problem of the parents or whether it's a problem we can just blame government for this. I mean, we love blaming government for everything, really.
I think that there's a performativity culture which puts a lot of pressure on teachers. Teachers are judged for their exam results. They're seen as an effective teacher. The more A's that they get, they are condemned by their principal and by the parents if they're not pulling in the same number of A's. And so I know for some teachers, they feel that if there's a child who's going to perform badly in a test, maybe a special classroom would be a better place for them because they're just going to pull down the average. And if we have a culture like that, where children are judged just by their grades, then it creates a pressure for teachers to kind of push those children out of the mainstream classroom. And that's really problematic.
Okay, but we're worried. I mean, I'm a parent myself. My child doesn't excel. We've been taught that that's the way towards a better life. And if I don't do well in my exam, what happens?
You know, I think that education is not a race. It's not about, you know, achievement. I think we've got to get past this. It's not about comparison with anyone. And I think that we've lost the meaning of education. Education comes from these two very brilliant Latin words, e ducer, e to bring out of and ducer the treasure within. So education actually is a discovery. We know everyone. Everyone is unique and special, and there's a treasure within them. And our role as a teacher, as a parent, as a person in society is to blossom that person. And they're going to look very different from each other. But somehow we've got into this KPI, you know, retentive pursuit that we all, like rats running around in a cage kind of thing. And I think we need to move away from that. It's extremely difficult because, as you said, Mira, it's linked to success and future. You're destroying my child's future if you don't send him for tuition kind of talk. I think we need to come back to the meaning of education and what we want for our children, which I think is to be, as John Lennon said, to be happy. Yeah.
And to earn more money at some stage.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Hello, good morning. My name is Lily.
Good morning.
I have a 5-year-old going to 6 next year. Most of the parents with kids that has difficult learning and also behavioral, they tend to send them to homeschool as early as 7 years old. Is this going to be a good benefit for those kids with no problem at all, but is to try a new education system which is home-based?
Okay, so typically developing children and homeschooling is your question. We have private school, international school, government school, vernacular schools, homeschooling.
I think that's a tough one because I'm going to speak as a parent first. For me, I think school is important from a social learning perspective as well because children learn to be with other children. They have activities that are beyond just learning activities. You know, that's where they learn to stand up for themselves, deal with bullies, all the other aspects of learning as well. And if you send your child to a learning center, I'm not saying it's wrong, it's a personal choice, but you have to ask yourself why you're doing it. And if it's only purely for an academic reason, then maybe that's not the right choice you're making, because you have to look at the holistic picture. Now, there are families that I work with who send their children to learning centers, and for the very reasons that you mentioned, that their learning is at a slower pace, they have different needs, they can't quite cope with functioning in a regular big classroom, and you know, the other options of private schooling, international schooling, is financially not viable. Yeah, that may be the right place for them. Of course, our government states that every child needs to be in a receiving an education, and they don't always recognize some of these learning centers as education centers. But I think as a parent, wherever you send your child to, think about the holistic aspect of learning and not just the learning of academics per se, and whether your child is going to get that from that environment.
But there is no perfect system, Dr. Rajani.
There isn't. And nothing in life is perfect, is it, Meera? We're going to have to face different challenges when we are adults as well. And I think sometimes we have to think about things like that when we're deciding on the right education system for our own children.
Okay. I'm going to be very hard on the parents right now. Do you think parents have become complacent as far as our children's education is concerned? I leave it to the school, I'll let them take care of it.
As a parent, I would say, yeah, there are many parents who are complacent. As a professional, I would say, yes, sometimes we tend to blame the school or the teacher, and a lot of it depends on, you know, we expect that the teacher should be the one who teaches our children how to deal with the bullies, etc. I think it's got to be a partnership. I don't feel that we should say it's all on the parents or all on the teachers. You know, coming back to what we're saying about teachers, you know, I have a big age gap with my own kids, and I still remember my eldest daughter was in a local school, and when she was in standard six, she came back one day and she said, the teacher said that, you know, it's not only about getting the A's, but helping your friends to improve. And the teacher in the class actually put kids who were doing better next to children who were struggling. And she was actually sitting to a girl who was struggling to even read and do simple arithmetic. Prior to that, she wanted to become a teacher, and then she realized she didn't have the patience. But, you know, and I thought that was such a good message. Sadly, the teacher left the school that following year. Unfortunately, this same school has now become a high-performance school. So I can see that the KPIs of the teachers have changed. And then streaming came in, and, you know, I think it started segregating children more and more. But I don't blame the teachers, because some of the older teachers who were still there would voice out their frustrations that what is expected of us is so different to what was expected of us 10 years ago. I do feel for the teachers as well.
Yeah, again, I guess I would have sympathy for the teachers. I think that the admin tasks that they have to do, the amount of paperwork that they have to do, the increasing social expectations of what people think schools should be able to do, there's just so much pressure on teachers. And I think it's easy to blame teachers when things go wrong, but actually, you've got to look at that context where teachers that I speak to want to do the best for their kids. The parents that I speak to all want to do the best for their kids. But the parents are incredibly busy, the teachers are incredibly busy, and somewhere in between that, the children get lost.
Questions?
Hi, first-time mother. My question is that how early should I identify whether my kids have delayed growing development or difficulties in growing up? Because when we talk about acceptance, before we, you know, blame all the teachers, our mothers and all, this kind of generation of mother, sometimes I don't know what is right, what is wrong. So I do based on my guts. So my question is that how early should I know whether my son is okay or not?
Okay. How old before is your child?
5 months plus.
Okay.
And I've seen Dr. Amma once, that's why I'm here. Because he told me my son is okay, but we keep on going back and forth to the hospital, and it's all about development. And I don't really know what is the indicator for me to know whether my son is okay or not before I, you know, go to another step. I need to know that so that when I accept what is going on, I know where to go, whether homeschool or not homeschool, whether he needs special attention or not.
Sure.
How early is it supposed to be?
Sure, thank you. inundated with information. Dr. Amar?
I think it's difficult to say because children are changing over time. Huh? And it's difficult to give you a single benchmark, but because there's a big crowd here, I'd like to give you one benchmark that I use quite a bit. 18 months is a very significant time. And, you know, we often say that if a child can't speak 6 words with meaning by 18 months, we are concerned. Most children at 18 months should be able to speak about 20, 30 words with meaning. So if a child can't speak 6 words with meaning at 18 months, I think I'll be a bit worried. But I like to watch the whole development, his social development, how he interacts with the environment, interacts with you, all his other things like, you know, how he interacts with food, his motor milestones. I think all those are equally important. But if you want one single benchmark, that's it. I think the best thing in life is to find someone who's sensible, who's got children, talk to them. If a pediatrician, if you've got who's sensible, might be also useful to talk to and watch your child's development.
I can feel for you. So much happening. You don't know the right way forward. I think sometimes worrying about the unknown can get the better of you. Perhaps just enjoy the everyday that you have with your child, really.
Can I just add in the buku record kesehatan, which is produced by the Ministry of Health for all newborn babies in Malaysia. Unfortunately, if your child is born in a private hospital, you do not automatically get that book. It's a child health record that goes from 0 to 5. And if your child's born in a private hospital, you can go request it at a maternal and child health clinic. In there, throughout the different months of a child's growth and development, there are checklists that parents can fill in to track whether or not their child is developing normally. And I think that is an excellent resource which is underutilized. It's in Bahasa Malaysia, but for those of you who struggle with Bahasa Malaysia, then go online to look at milestones. Many families look at just motor and speech now. They forget about social feeding and all the other milestones. But I think at any point, if you're worried, go and speak to a professional or even your friends. Yeah.
Okay. Question?
My name is Felix. I'm a parent of a child who's on the spectrum. She's 12 years old. She goes to a government school. I just want to say at this point that some of the best teachers I have seen are the teachers who work with these special needs kids. And when my child went in at 8 years old for her first year in special needs, she didn't speak. Within 6 months, the teachers managed to get her to speak. And this is school in PJ. The challenge that the teachers there are facing is the support from the government. Literally, it's like a concrete shack. And when we were, as parents, trying to get together to raise some funds to build the building, the Ministry of Education is throwing a lot of roadblocks in our way. It appears there's no political will to do something about this. As I was just talking to someone here, they just told me that in a lot of other countries, the government does take on the responsibility of developing these kids.
Okay.
I want to ask Dr. Amma if that's something that he sees will be happening here in the future.
See, everything government. Thank God he came.
Mira, I work a lot with NGOs as well. And I think that's one of the major movements forward, working with NGOs. Recently, I tried to get a teacher aid for a parent in a school. And the parent was going to fund the teacher aid. And the teacher refused. The headmaster refused. The local regional authority education, MOE, refused. So we wrote higher up and got approval within a day. So I think there are people who are in Ministry of Education, and even the Deputy Minister of Education is quite keen and supportive of inclusive education. I think we can reach out to them and get past some of these local bureaucratic needs that are in our way.
Okay.
I think we have to change the ground. I think that's what I'm talking about. Teachers are harassed with their workload. They can't cope with special needs kids in their class. Parents are also very keen that their children move forward academically, so they're concerned when the teacher is spending time with other special needs kids. All these issues are not resolved. Our classrooms are also very huge in size. We haven't resolved many of our infrastructure issues. So it's not easy being a teacher and handling all these issues. And so for that reason, inclusion doesn't succeed very well in our country. So I think we need a major push. There's a DASA, but not much resources on the ground, as our gentleman was talking about.
You have a question over there.
Hi, my name is Fauzia, and I have an 8-year-old who is on the high-functioning spectrum.
where I feel like there's a huge gap. I mean, I was struggling from the very beginning. At 3.5, he was diagnosed at NASOM, mildly autistic. And when I asked them, where do I go next? And they said, go and look up for help. He needs speech therapy. He needs occupational therapy. But I said, where do I go? They said, go and look out with the hospitals, which was all just directing us to the private sector. I did try, and I got disappointed at the first attempt. And I said, no, I'm going to take it on to my hands. And I actually found a school which eventually accepted him. And first we started with a shadow. Within 3 months, the principal said, look, he's so well behaved, he doesn't need a shadow. We moved on from there, but it was just a struggle every day to find a space for him. There was a huge milestone, and I found a system, a teacher who's actually sitting next to me. She's a teacher for my son. And and they've been doing an amazing job. I feel like there's a huge gap in the system, which is not just about doctors or mothers. It's about the whole education system that doesn't have a platform for children like ours.
Thank you. Dr. Amara, you have often spoken about...
I should not
about...
work in government anymore.
You shouldn't have said yes to today's forum.
I feel for you, and I actually feel especially for the poor in our country. I think if you've got money, you've got a chance to go and look for resources. You can go to an alternative education system, what people call homeschool, but it's not really true homeschool. You can find something, but when you don't have money and you're in a rural environment, it's actually very hard to get resources. So that's why I'm still in the civil service. I believe that this should come through the civil service. We pay taxes. This should come back down on a scheme. I think it requires every one of us, not just me or Rajini or Lucy or Mira, but every one of us advocating for this, pushing for this, writing about it, talking about it, asking for it. Otherwise, I think we'll end up with this system for a very, very long time. We should not have it.
Can we take things into our own hands? Which is what...
she said yes.
Yes.
What I mean in our own hands, I think we advocate. We put the government there. We want them to be there to do things for our people. And so I think we should actually ask for what we want in the system that we have. And I think we need to advocate with MOE. Can I again say that Ministry of Education is very receptive to us. But it mustn't be one person advocating. I think it's got to be the society advocating for it.
Okay. It would seem that preschool seem to be more inclusive than, and then after that when they go into primary school, how do we get that continuation, you know, even through primary and secondary school?
In Malaysia, the time is right for this to happen. I think it's an open door and we can all push it further open, but it's a heavy door. So unless everyone's pushing, it's not going to happen. And at the moment, it's the parents of children who have disabilities who are the only ones who are fighting. There's not enough of a general impetus from everyone else in the classroom saying, actually, I want this classroom to be diverse. I want this child to be educated alongside my child. And until everyone's on that same page, it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a struggle.
From what I'm hearing, I think then the biggest push should come from parents of typically developing children. What do you think? Question over there.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a very quick question. Is it like an inborn characteristic in a child, or can it be developed later on in later stage through the environment, through the, you know, schooling system? For example, when a child move one country to another country, or from, you know, one school to another school? Because I've seen, for example, in myself as well, I've always been in a state-owned school in my home country, which is Pakistan, and I've seen my learning, you know, curve has been ups and down based on the environment and the teachers and a lot of other factors.
Thank you. And Lucy. Lucy has done research on who you refer to as the third culture kid, haven't you?
Yeah, and this is actually a more general debate within educational circles. So there's a conflict between those who take a medical model of special educational needs and those who adopt a social model of social education needs. I'm a sociologist, so I lean towards the social and understanding that it's the environment that affects behavior. It affects what's defined as normal behavior. What's defined as normal behavior in one society is different than what's in another society. The way that we expect children to behave in a classroom in the UK is we expect them to argue with the teacher and to ask why and to be very vocal and outgoing. We expect them to move around the classroom. Now, if you took a child who was behaving like that in a British primary school and you dropped them into a Malaysian government school, they would be seen as a very naughty student indeed, because it's not accepted. And so, yes, it's about how society defines behaviour and how we choose to respond to it. Now, I'm not saying there's nothing real about it, that medicine doesn't matter. Of course, there are kind of medical issues involved as well. But whether we see it as a problem is social. And I think that a special educational need is not a problem with a child. It's a problem with a relationship between the child and the educational expectations that are put upon them. So are those educational expectations appropriate for that child? So really, we have to look at the problem lying with the whole system rather than seeing the child as the problem.
Question?
Hi, my name is Jalita. I run a small kindergarten, a tiny one, in relation to what we're talking about, big government schools. The children that we have are usually from middle to upper class families. I'm just kind of reflecting on what we were talking about just now, about the very big heavy door that everyone's trying to push. One thing that happens when non-typically developing children coming to my school and asking, where we go, yes, come. And then when some other parents see it, like you say, they question, why do my kids have to be in the same class as non-typically developing kids? And me, as the person who's running the school, I just stick to my guns and say, yeah, this is how we do it here. And in not so many words, say, if you don't like it, you can go. Yeah, some do go. But I think the vast majority, they stay on. After 6 months to a year, you see them at sports days, you see them at concerts, and you see that parents of typically developing kids, they have kind of changed their perspective. I think we can change what these people think, because people generally, if they, unless they have a non-typically developing child in their family, they really don't care. Right now, you're just worried about your own family. You've got to bring up your family. You've got to make the, that's all that's important right now. So that's just what I wanted to share.
Good point. Questions? Yes?
I am actually a student, international school student in year 10. And I would just like to question about the negative social stigma about students with special needs in these schools. For example, there's a peer who has autism, I think. And it's very disturbing because I have a brother who has cerebral palsy myself. To see this kid with autism get shamed and his name is used as a joke whenever someone gets angry or say something that is not very appropriate. Yeah, how can we fix that negative social stigma to be more accepting and be more positive and not to look down and demean others?
Before we go on, you're a very mature year 10.
I think we all want to say something.
Yes.
Thank you for coming today. And I think you could be an advocate for that child. And I would suggest you get together a small group of your friends who are like-minded. If your school has a special education needs coordinator, go and talk to them and say, we want to educate our fellow students. You can stand up. You can do a short video. In fact, we're now looking for young people to make videos of siblings or friends whom they know. Local Malaysian videos. We see a lot on the YouTube about this from other countries. But, you know, you can do a lot. And I would suggest you start by doing it in your school. You know, saying you want to run an assembly about it, about being nice to people. And you might actually touch the hearts of some of your teachers who may indirectly not be supporting this bullying in school, but they're obviously not standing up to the children who are saying this. So I would strongly encourage you to go and... Is there a special education needs coordinator in your school? Yeah. So go and see them. You know, they're always waiting for kids like you to come because they want to advocate for these kids. And I know that from my work with many of the schools. You know, I think if you start within your own classroom first, you're not going to change everybody's thoughts. And we have to understand as parents that basically a lot of upbringing happens at home. And I always get this where parents say, oh, but if he's in a class with children with special needs, he's going to come back with bad behavior. Well, I will say to you that as a mom, my kids come back with words that they have learned from schools. And it's not up to the teachers to stop the kids from using those words. It's up to us as parents to filter behavior. So I think you're not going to change everybody's mindset, but even if you change the mindset of two or three of the bullies, as I call them, you'll be doing something good.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Hello, hi, my name is Mariam. When we talk about these special needs children, we always focus on the parents as well as the teachers, but we should not forget the peers, because I also had the experience during my primary school days where we had a special needs child. I don't exactly know what his condition was, but he couldn't speak to us. He was pretty much there, you know, in front of the classroom. I mean, we didn't bully him or anything like that, but we completely ignored him because we had no idea how to interact with him. We don't know how to deal with him. But the parents, teachers, you know, especially parents of a typically developing child, should also educate their children on how to interact. Basically, make these people feel like they are no different from you.
Thank you very much. Question?
I have two children. I think they're typically developing. I'm not sure, actually. There's not some spectrum. What is typically developing?
We all have special needs, remember?
Yes, we all have special needs, absolutely. There's so much work to do with inclusive education. It's the government, the NGOs, the infrastructure, teacher training, etc. And there are many things that we can change, and there are many things that we can't. But the one thing I think that we can focus on is ourselves as parents, whether typically developing, non-typically developing, or people who are not parents yet. Our outlook and our mindset. You know, we are known as a kiasu society, who wants like the A's and everything.
That's Singapore, not us.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, we're number two.
Yeah, we're number two, yeah.
They're too close that, you know, it's contagious. So, and you know, how many of us as parents who are in school, if we hear that there is a child who has special needs in the class, and, you know, we feel like they're holding our children back or something, we'd be like, oh no, really? You know, as opposed to embracing diversity, and this will trickle down onto our children and hence produce children who are not patient or who tease those children with special needs. Things like empathy and consideration and kindness, they're like left behind. So really, if we want to push against that heavy door, we need really to all, and this is a reminder to myself as a parent. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Just echoing that, let's be absolutely clear about the research evidence on this. The research evidence shows that children who are in diverse classrooms do better academically. So if a child who is advanced academically is paired up with a child who's weaker in that particular academic area, it is not holding them back. Being able to articulate their learning and to explain it to someone else requires a deeper learning. So if any of you were to be explaining long division to somebody, you'd have to have a really sound understanding of long division. It's not enough to just know what to do to be able to explain it. So your children benefit academically by working alongside their academically weaker in that particular area peers. It's a win-win situation.
Okay, over there.
Hi, I'm Rakesh. I live in UK. I'm here temporarily for a project with the government. I used to work for Equality and Human Rights Commission in UK with portfolio for education, health, sport and other areas. I'm just wondering if one of the discussions missing in this room is the use of legal framework as well to shift the culture in the institutions, particularly with all the encouragement and the positive steps being taken so far. But there is still a lot of reluctance in the educational framework, and I'm shocked to hear that the Ministry of Education say haven't met their target. So who's holding them accountable? What is the panel's thought in terms of use of legal framework? How can ordinary members of public, especially people from the poorest background, get access to information around their legal rights to challenge institutions who refuse to move? Thank you.
Thank you. Lots of big words.
Right?
Yes. Government, Dr. Amar.
Right now I'm speaking as a civil servant.
What's the difference?
And part of the public, yeah. I think the Bar Council has done quite a bit of work in that area and championed it, trying to change some of the Education Act, which actually says that if you can't be educated at a normal school, you have to go to special school or even to welfare. So I think they're the ones who have championed the most. But can I say that right now we have no real good mechanisms to hold government accountable for failure in targets. I think that's not a clear mechanism how we can go about that. As part of the NECIC network of many NGOs, we are writing a rights document for parents, probably sometime middle of next year, where we want to spell out the rights for every specific disability and ask parents to go and actually advocate for that. But I want to come back to the lady over there who was speaking just before you, and I think that we can't leave it to parents of special needs alone. I think that's where we've got to change. Most of our NGOs, most of the people who are fighting are parents who have got a child with needs. I think it's got to be all of us, parents with children who've got learning problems and without, who get together to try and change our education system and the system that supports children in the country. But I think we're very far away in terms of the rights that we know happen in the UK.
Okay. One last question. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Yes.
Dr. Amar is right, because parents with special needs, we are already too busy taking our children from therapies to therapies. I'm a mother with a child with Down syndrome. I'm very lucky because she is in inclusive education. Because she is with Down syndrome, so it's much easier to handle. So I go around selling myself to do disability awareness talk. First, I go to my son's. My son is typically developing. I tell the teacher, I want to give a talk. When my daughter was getting admitted to the school, then I tell the teacher, I want to do disability awareness talk to the class. And then I want to do disability talk to the school. I keep on telling people, I can talk about disability awareness to any school. Because I think a lot of parents, they want to help as well, but they just do not know how to. They don't even know what is right and what is wrong. So I first talk to the children. Sometimes the teacher, after seeing it, they say that, okay, maybe I can organize something for you to talk to the parents. So I think there are lots of parents here also have good intention, but they just don't know how. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. One last question.
I'm a teacher, and I have worked with inclusive learning. We have no choice. Okay, we have to take them. That's the school criteria. And it works. And parents of typically developing kids accept it because they have no choice. They either have to leave or they accept their child. And their children have been affected. Sometimes, you know, they are hit or something happens in the playground or whatever. But they've accepted the child, and the children actually accept the other child as part of their classroom, because there's no choice. Of course, there's problems in classroom management, which is why teachers ask for students to be put in a special class. But as in this school, we don't have that choice. We just have to include them. And they do go off at certain lessons to a special needs teacher, but otherwise they're included all the time.
Fantastic. Is that a preschool or a primary school?
Actually, right through to secondary school.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We're going to conclude. Lucy, you have a message for us?
My final point would be just to say, we get the society that education tells children is normal. So if education tells children we should be inclusive, we should accept people regardless of difference, then that's the society we'll get.
I think education is a right for everyone, and as parents we should be advocating for all kids, not just our own. For parents of children with different needs, you've got to band together to push and lead the way, in a sense. Yes, I know you're busy, but you still went ahead and did what I'm always encouraging parents to do. Go out there, you talk for your child. There's no point the doctor coming into the school or writing a letter or things like that. If it comes from you and you gather other families together, it works better.
And we end with government.
Thank God I'm retiring next year. I think it's personal, it's societal, and it's a policy, what we've all been talking about. At a personal level, I think never ignore a child who's got needs. Pitch in, do something, act. Don't leave it alone. On that personal level, we've all got to go and do that. The second level is societal, and what Ranjini and Lucy were saying. I think as a society, we need to band together, parents of children with needs and parents without, and work together. And if you have no platform, come and find me. I've got lots of platforms which can harness your energy to come together. But thirdly, at a policy level, I think the biggest policy change we can make is if we can change the Department for Special Education into the Department for Inclusive Education. It's a huge policy difference. Instead of segregating children into special education, we change them into a Department of Inclusive Education, and then their whole focus in life would be to get children included.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Rajani Sarvanandan, Dr. Lucy Bailey, and Dr. Amar Singh. Thank you.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.